On April 20th, 2012, poet Melanie Moore Huber came to Writer House to read from her new book, Axe in Hand. Interview by poet and Writer House instructor Rosalind Elliott.
But I wanted to start out, since the topic initially was women in poetry, that's us. So I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about kind of gender politics things. And,
oh boy.
And they're not very complicated, but okay. You know, I've heard it discussed a lot. Like, is there such a thing as women's poetry, first of all? Do you think there is?
Most definitely. There is definitely women's poetry. You look at Sylvia Plath, you have Maxine Cumin. There, especially in this century, a lot of people have asked, where are the women poets? And I think that it's becoming less gender specified as we move towards the next century. But earlier on, it was very important for there to be a women's movement, and there was a women's movement. Mm-hmm. And women's poetry has been ignored from the dawn of time. Mm-hmm. Sappho, Lao Tzu, whereas, like, Sappho is a Greek poet. The Greek poets that remain and are remembered are usually the men poets, and all their work was retranscribed again and again. Sappho's work, on the other hand, was left to literally rot. And so we only have bits and pieces of her work now. And that's kind of the way it's been till actually recently, I think, with the 40s, 50s, and 60s. The voice of women to be struggling to be heard is a big part of what poetry is. So yeah, there's definitely women's poetry, but I would argue that women's poetry, people sometimes say, well, they need to talk about more universal themes. All they're talking about is family and home. I think the themes that women address are just as profound and powerful as the themes that men are addressing, and they do write about war, and they do write about political themes, but they center it more often. So, most definitely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to speak up here so Susan can hear
okay.
me.
Can you hear me, or do I need to... Are you all right? You can hear me? Okay.
You actually
I'll try to talk louder.
Got into one of my the second part of my question about the editors asking women to talk about bigger themes or something more universal or something more important than, you know,
than family and children,
than families or
things like that.
Yeah.
Making lace, you know. Well, Belle Waring, I know, has a wonderful poem about somebody who knows how to make lace. So there, I think it's changing too. I
think
agree
so.
With you.
But wasn't it Louise Gluck? She was writing about the dictators of Latin America.
Yes.
Some dictator rather had the jar of ears.
Yes.
Carolyn Forché, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's not exactly feminine. who do you think of as pioneers in the women's poetry movement?
Sharon Olds, Sylvia Plath, of course, H.D.
How about Anne Saxton?
Yeah, Anne Saxton, the lady that just died recently.
Marianne Moore.
Audrey and Rich.
Rich.
Yeah.
She, I love Audrey and Rich. She was definitely a pioneer. She had insight into Harvard, and she went to Harvard, and yet she pulled away from that group, and she constantly was pushing up against the boundaries of the patriarchy, which does still exist today. VIDA, for example, I don't know if you guys know VIDA. It's a women's writers organization, and they keep track. They do statistics about how many women are getting published now compared to how many men. The thing with poetry, and Poetry Magazine in particular with Dawn Cher, they're more equal. In fiction and nonfiction and every other field besides poetry, it's like 8 to 2. Women are not getting published. A lot of people say that is because women don't submit as much. As someone who's been an editor before, I can say that the 9 out of 10 of submissions are from men, and they do submit more. Which is why I think, as someone who's in the position as an editor, I solicit women, and I will, like, I'm a book reviewer too, and I get out there and I specifically seek moms who are busy, and I know they're busy, and I relate. But they're brilliant, and they deserve to be heard. So I try to encourage them. And I think I take that responsibility seriously. And not that I'm a man basher or anti-man. I'm not at all. I just really feel like women, we need the connectedness. We need the support from one another to work the system that we have, because it is still very much a patriarchal system. There's still 90% of the editors of major magazines are men, the main editors. Now, you'll find associate editors that are females. I mean, I'm a book review editor, but of course the main editor's male. And that's the way it is over the board, and they're the ones that make, you know, crucial decisions. Probably went off on a tangent there.
No, I'm glad. That's great.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I just wondered... Well, I'll ask you this now, and then we'd love to hear some of your poems, and then, because I think this should probably come before you start reading. But I was thinking about, I was remembering once that Andre and Rich said that it wasn't marriage that interfered with their writing, but it was the children. And, you know, as I read your poems, I thought, well, this woman's children are her muses. It seems like,
much of
from
the time,
reading.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you would talk about that a little bit. I mean, if some poets really just come out and say they write around their children, they, you know, write in spite of their children or whatever. But yours are in your poems, and they sound like your inspiration.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear something about that.
It's both.
Okay.
I don't write when they're awake.
Yeah.
I write when they're asleep. But, of course, I'm going to write about them because it's a part of who I am.
Right.
So I just wrote an essay about reconciling motherhood with writing. And then when I got to the end of the essay, I put, it's impossible. You cannot. You can't reconcile parenting and writing, because they both take so much out of you. And I will do binges on everything. I admit I am a horrible, horrible housekeeper. I binge housekeep and I binge write. And the thing I try to focus on that makes me not feel like a failure as a mother or as a writer is all my children, at the end of the day, they know that they're loved. And that's number one. And my kids will request, like, I bring them as audiences. My children come with me when I do readings.
And there are 5.
And there are 5, so that usually, you know, doubles, triples my audience. Because I bring my family and my kids and their friends. So they all come and they all participate in that way. They're a big part of every little thing that I do, and yet this is very separate. And it is very personal, and it is very much me. And there are times when I have been in the middle of a poem, and I have been neglectful and locked my door and been like, give me 20 minutes. I know you want dinner, or I know you need my attention, but you must give me 20 minutes to finish this thought, and then I will be with you. So at the same time, though, I think that's good, because they see me as a person, not just as someone there to do everything they want, whenever they want it. They know that I, too, have dreams. I, too, have things that I want for myself. So, would I be a better writer if I didn't have children? Or would I... No. I think being the mother... Not that you need to be a mother to be a good writer... But for me, it informs every mm-hmm. everything I do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the other way around, would I be a better mother if I wasn't writing? And I think that's one I have a hard time with, honestly. I don't know. Like, coming here today, my husband ended up leaving town because a friend's father had died and passed away, and so he left. And I had planned this months ahead of time, so I had to leave. So then I spent, like, the first 3 hours of the day trying to find rides for my kids' places and feeling guilty because I wasn't going to be there. And, you know, the whole guilt thing is a big part of the process, and I'm sure you understand that you struggle with that no matter what, mm-hmm. being a writer, just a person. So
in Nan's poetry, is there much of this conflict you can glean from the poems? In other words, if you didn't have the author's name on top, would you be able to decide this poem must be written by a woman, this must be written by a man?
Sometimes. Yeah. Not always.
Yeah.
And some of the best poems I read, I like that I can't tell they're written by a man or a woman. They're universal in theme. But sometimes, definitely, you can tell, you know, that this was definitely either a mother or a woman who's been there. So, yeah, and I like all different types and styles of poetry, too. I am attracted to, like, Mary Oliver and Jane Hirschfield, women who definitely write from a gender perspective, but I'm also attracted to those that... I mean, I like Pound and Elliot, and they're the most chauvinistic, ridiculous... They're brilliant, but they definitely had issues. So, I don't necessarily judge a poem on gender. Let me just put it that way. And when it comes right down to it, I don't necessarily want my poetry judged by gender, but of course it will be. You know, it's going to be. That's the way the world works. So, I acknowledge it and I celebrate it, but I look to the day that the poems will speak for themselves, whatever the voice behind the poem is. If that made any sense whatsoever. Mm. Okay.
Well, it did, and I think they do speak for themselves. and I think we'd love to hear something.
Okay. I did not, like, plan to specific poems. So, since we're talking about family, though, and I just turned right to it, I'll go ahead and I'll read... This is probably one of my favorites. It's about my daughter, Anlie. And I went back to college in my mid-30s when they had just started school. And so I had been a stay-at-home mom, and this was a big change for the family and the household. And this poem was kind of a result of the adaption that we were all doing. And it's called Rock, Paper, Scissors. If you have a book and you want to read along, it's 19. All right. She sells seashells at the seashower. Seashells at the seashower. Seashower, seashower. My daughter has the S sound down, but she still hasn't quite got her R's. So she practices as she cuts snowflakes to hang on the windows. Keeps all the scraps and glues them into ice paper sculptures. What is today again? She asks for the third time. What time will you be home? How many minutes? The answer is never soon enough, and I wish I could tell her it doesn't matter if there is no ocean, no shore. She can still spend her day looking for sea glass or imagining that bottle, the one tossed from a ship while the ship was taking on water. Or, if it helps, think about the message inside, a secret note. Not so secret, really, because bottles tossed in oceans always say the same thing. I love you. I'll miss you. See you again someday. Instead, I tell her about what I found in the trash. Sheet music. Fur or lease. I saved it to quarter the pages and weave some words among the half and whole notes. And this is how we save a ship. Make a big thing small. Fold it over, put it in a bottle or a pocket, carry it with us wherever we go. Can we? Can we really? No. But I will not mention regret. The one thing I do believe, rock hard paperweights keep the wind from blowing all of us away. You don't have to. Did you want me to read more, or do you?
Yeah, why don't you keep going for a few? And
okay. We were talking about, Rose and I, that when you get through a manuscript, you've read it so many times, you're like so sick of the poems. but let's go ahead. Let's deal with that issue right up front. This is called Dig In. It's really annoying when everything becomes poetic. When cleaning the kitchen becomes a metaphor for life. When walking the dog becomes a metaphor for life. When blowing your nose becomes a metaphor for, maybe not life, probably relationships. When does life become life? And living grand enough in just the living, washing dishes is just washing dishes, and that's fine, because after all, you need to eat off those dishes. And an empty plate doesn't have to be the symbol for world hunger, and a full plate the symbol of gluttony. Let's just sit down, founder on fried chicken, mashed potatoes oozing with gravy, corn on the cob swimming in butter, and clean up. So, sometimes I write like anti-poem poems, which is counterproductive, but I do, because poems do get annoying. There's some really, really sad poems in here. I don't know where you guys want to go next. Sad, happy, silly, mad. I mean, whatever range.
Give us a sad one.
A sad one? There's so many. Where to choose? Okay, let's see. I'll read At the Outline of Night. Let me find it. This one I wrote after, here's a really happy thought. Sorry, guys. I had a dear friend of mine commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't heard from him in 20 years. It was kind of a first love kind of thing. And he called me after 20 years and, how you doing? Caught up with me. Oh, by the way, I've got a gun. Which is not funny, but it's, yeah. So, let me see if I can find it at the outline right.
It's at 47.
Thank you. You're so helpful. 47. This came from that. At the Outline of Night. This is a hard one. Okay. Why did you come here to haunt this song? You faded from the sway of the earth until still some echo, some blur on the horizon. I can feel your emptiness on my skin. Don't stay. Don't go. Dawn, I refuse you. Let the multitude of days be one night. I take it back, not the night you called, a gun at your temple. I take it back. Here, a sunset. We are climbing a rusted water tower. Unremarkable clouds above us, a dove singing down the sun. The light is overcome as acorns succumb to gravity. The quiet is toppled by their falling into a fire of leaves. Paper thin, crisp scent of autumn flickers against the ever-growing dark. And my brown hair in your eyes, copper, topaz, still warm.
I sort of like some of the freak show poems.
The freak shows, yeah. Being a mother, definitely. Which one did you like? Do you remember?
Well, I read a few and I liked them all, actually.
Okay, there's one about Tesla. I don't know if you guys know Tesla. And there's one about elephants. And there's one about a girl that had a disease that made her feet really, really big.
Well, the Tesla one's pretty memorable.
Okay. So Tesla, do you guys know who Tesla? Tesla was an electrician. He's actually the one responsible for everything we have now, more so than Edison. Tesla invented AC-DC currents. You know the big electronic, I don't know if you've ever seen those big things that do the lightning out of them. Yeah, that's a real technical term. It's like a transformer, but it's like a donut, and then it does these lightning.
Where they used to have them in parties. Yes. So they were like, you had to control it. Yeah.
Right, so Tesla was responsible for all that. And he was also obsessed with the number 3. And he would not stay in a room unless it had 3 on it. And he would not eat something unless there was like a 3 pattern. So that's the things I pulled from for this poem. Oh, I'm not going to, yeah, I think the pigeon wife thing should, okay, yeah, he called a pigeon his wife, so I think that I should mention he was very eccentric. Okay, the wind blew all night. This morning it is still indiscriminately shedding limbs and knocking wind chimes down. There is no logic to what we love. At first, the lure was a breadcrumb trail she followed to his window, where with peculiar and solemn awe he watched her coo. The gentle swell of her white throat transformed him. The sound made everything conductively clear to him. If he could just divide it all by 3, the ledge, feathers, and flight, the wind, coils, and alternating currents, the spin of the earth, the soil, and gravity. He'd build a tower for her, a tower which would charge the air with limbs of electricity reaching out across the night sky to the filament inside of glass, a hushed glow 3 miles in the distance. Then he sang, so softly she was coaxed inside. He named her his muse. She spent the rest of her days pillowed in a metal cage. When she was gone, he made an altar from her dainty bones. Nothing made sense again.
Tesla was a character in a movie. A movie about a magician.
Yes, I know who you're talking about. Was it Houdini?
There were two movies that came out the same year about magicians.
The Illusionist. I think the other one was the one Tesla was in.
Yes.
I saw The Illusionist.
Yes, He was a character in that movie, and it was a memorable movie.
He also was really freaked out by pearls.
Pearls.
I love that.
Yeah, I don't know why. But yeah.
I can see why you wrote a poem about it. How could you not?
Yeah, a lot of poems come from like very fascinating people that I'll read about, and I'll be like, I cannot help but write a poem about that person.
What was the date of his life?
You know? Good question.
Wasn't he would have been a contemporary
same time as Edison, so that's
1900s
the 1918 1920 is in my head, but I don't know if that's right. Mm-hmm. So don't quote me on that, but yeah, definitely like the early 20s.
Well, there's a lot of humor in a lot of these poems, too, so
work.
If you want to go in that direction, that would be fun.
Okay. So we go from sad to... Yeah, this is kind of an ADD collection, and I really just threw everything in there.
We're in here.
From humor to despair.
to...
Hello.
Work.
Yeah, I came back early because the paper hit at 4 o'clock, so I
guess
I'm sitting on a little bit.
Oh no.
Oops.
The,
oh no.
Glad you came
Which
back.
Which one?
Yeah.
Seagulls?
Yeah. This one or the... This is Sepia. I think it was Sepia, yeah.
Oh no.
Hmm.
Sorry about that.
Hi. Glad you made it. We were reading sad poems, now we're going to try to read some happy poems, if I can find one. Well, this is... I don't know. Okay. Did you have a funny... Well, there's the... How many poets does it take to change a light bulb?
That light bulb right there actually needs to be changed.
How many poets are there?
Okay, let me find that one, because that's... Yeah. I do a lot of self-mocking, because how can you not make fun of poets? Because they are kind of funny. Or at least I find myself funny, because this is very true. How many poets does it take to change a light bulb? Behold the light bulb, glowy thing, filament of spiral flame, oh bulb of light, light bulbing bud, oh bud of fire, changing the screw. Circular motion of hand, lefty loosey, righty tighty. Screw the screwing screws, screwed. Illuminate, ruminate, postulate. What was lighted of the bulb is light. Where does a light go when the room is not light? What light through yonder window breaks? Why, it is the east, and who am I? Who are you? Wait, where does this go again? Yeah. It's kind of how it works.
Let's see.
Okay. So we can go to parenting. We can go to Ars Poetica. God wearing shoes. Personal, painful father poems. Those are always grand.
Well, I like Ice Storm.
Okay, I like Ice Storm too. That's one of the ones I'm not sick of. So that's
good.
Oh, I shouldn't say that. That's not really not good. I'm so happy to have a poetry book. That's what I should say. But yeah, I've read the manuscript like 100 times, so yeah. I still can't believe people want to read it. It's like, oh, I've read it so many times. Okay, 67. Okay, the setting of this is Eastern Kentucky, where I lived for about 8 years in Hazard. And that's where the coal mines are, the strip mining is. And my husband was working for the power company at the time. And whenever there were storms, he would go out. And I would not see him for days because he'd be climbing all the poles. And 3 of my children were born there. So. Ice storm. The power was out in 3 states. The candle sputtered and died in a wickless wax puddle on the dresser. What light there was came from outside. We all crowded together. I clung to what inches of mattress I could. There was a leg over my neck and someone else's knee in my back. The baby latched onto my breast and would not be moved. Unmindful of the sound of sleet belting the house, they snored. Quiet gusts of breath rose, evaporated in the air. I waited for sleep. Or for light, or for my husband who was not here, who was somewhere out there climbing poles. Nothing came, not even dawn. It seemed the day could not quite gather itself. The children did not know when to wake up, so they slumbered on and on until the sound of groaning boughs. The house shuddered I rushed to a window. They followed, hands clutched whatever part of me they could reach, stuck their noses so close, their breath misted the glass. Outside, the oak split in two. The whole world crystallized. Even the gravel driveway turned prism. The house a crystal cocoon. And just inches from my front door, the ruin of a tree. For no good reason, I worried about the sparrows.
Thank you. That was...
So, did you select these... poems included here all on your own, or did you have consultation with friends and fans about what to include?
I think no book is a book by itself. You know, I don't think one person, there's never just one person that builds this. So yeah, I had people that I trusted, friends, close friends, and who knew me and my work. Yeah, they definitely helped me pick the poems to put in there, and there were several people that helped with the whole process of bringing it to life. So you don't think any book is a product of one person. There's always a team that brings it to life. Mm-hmm. So,
but what strikes me sometimes when I read poems in like in the New Yorker or New York Review book or the magazines, is that they don't make any sense to me at all. I mean, they might be sort of randomly generated words for all that I understand.
Right.
And so, I mean, your poems are eminently accessible.
Well, thank you. I'm glad.
But does anyone know what criteria is used by editors?
Good question.
Yeah, that makes me laugh. Criteria used by editors. It depends on the editor, the publication. You have publications that do like narrative style, which are straightforward and accessible poems, Billy Collins style poems. But there isn't, for example, I work with Raymond Hammond. His style is, what is this? Basically, if it shocks, if it causes some kind of emotional response, it doesn't necessarily have to make sense. If you feel something when you read it, that's what counts. So
they can use all the kind of naughty words in the whole language?
Naughty words.
Yes.
Again, it depends on your editor. It depends on your editor, what style they like. And there isn't like a specific criteria for what's acceptable or not, but there are different styles. Experimental, your language poets. Language poets don't make a lot of sense. And they don't just spell, the style of poetry isn't language, it's L equals A equals N equals, so you get that they're a little highfalutin, and I think you make a really good point, and this is something my husband, who is not a fan of poetry, says a lot, is, and I quote him in an essay I write, hi. So I will repeat that quote now, and please don't be offended. But I wrote an essay for the New York Quarterly, and I quote my husband a lot. He's not a fan of poetry. And I like what he has to say because it's so realistic, and it's so what people think. He said, poetry either hits you in the nuts or it does not. And that is true. He also said, and I like this too, why do poets always try to describe an orange a million different ways? It's round, and it's orange, it's an orange. Why can't you just say it's an orange? So I get where you're coming from, and I completely agree to some extent that the accessibility is an important part of trying to connect with your readers. But I do, honestly, and I will admit, intentionally be difficult at times because I do want to challenge the reader to make connections between images or thoughts or within themselves that maybe they wouldn't have made before. So I don't know if that answered your questions. Editorial guidelines, it's different per magazine, per editor. So there isn't a list that says you be intentionally obscure, check. There's not a list like that. So
this might be a time for me to come to one of these questions. I wonder if you would talk about the history of your manuscript, though. I mean, how long did it take to write the poems? How long did it take to find the publisher? Poets and Writers magazines sometimes has a little column of...
Let me have a drink of this
listing information like that about different poets who published this year, and they say, like, well, how many years did it take to actually write the poems, first of all?
Okay, some of the poems are 10 years old. The book itself took 3 years. Uh-huh. And then from the time it was accepted, a good year from the manuscript was complete, and then 100 read-throughs to get every comma, every word, every little nitpicky detail. So it is a big, prolonged process. How it came into being, I went to Hollins. A lot of the poems that I wrote there while I was a student are in here. There's a lot of poems that I'm always writing poetry, so a lot of it's just over the years collected and
I've heard about poetry chapbooks. Is that the chapbook? Or what is that chapbook?
Okay, some of this is from a chapbook called The Memory of Paper.
Yeah, and what is a chapbook?
It's just a smaller poetry book. Oh, it's 20 pages instead of 70.
Uh-huh.
It's just a lot smaller.
And it is also, is it something that people publish themselves, or do they have publishing houses?
Both. Yeah, you can. There's a lot of chapbooks published through Lulu, and there's a lot of Copper Canyon Press does chapbooks. I could think of a lot. There's a lot of presses that do chapbooks, and I like chapbooks as much as I like poetry books. Some people are kind of snooty about it and are like, it's not a full poetry book, but I think they're just as relevant today as manuscripts. Mm-hmm. So,
thanks. I think that was, I think you covered it.
So how did you get connected with New York Quarterly?
How did I? Well, actually, an online poetry workshop called Erratosphere. I would workshop when I was a stay-at-home mom and I had babies and I couldn't go anywhere to do anything. I would post poems in this workshop, and I don't know how, I just started talking to him about poetry, and thus began 8 years. I mean, he didn't just, oh, you're a wonderful poet, let me publish your book. It was 8 years I knew the guy, and I don't know, I started doing book reviews of other people's poetry. I think one of the most important things about being a poet is to be listening to what other people are saying, not just to throw your work out there and think people are going to be interested and want to listen. It's a conversation, and it might be as, I don't know how it works so much in fiction or nonfiction, but in poetry, this is a tradition and a conversation that's been going on for millenniums. And if you want people to listen to you, I definitely think you need to listen and know, you know, what the history is and what other people are saying about it. So, yeah, I won't get on a soapbox about that too much. But it definitely, I guess that's, we connected because we had a lot of the same poetic likes and philosophies and a eventually he just invited me to do a book. So, I don't know why, it just happened.
Well, we're glad it did.
Well, thank you.
That's great.
Glad I did, too.
Do you want to read a few more?
Okay. We went from happy to sad.
Well, what are your favorites?
What are my favorites? New ones.
Did you bring some?
I brought some new ones. Do you mind if I read new ones?
Please do.
Okay, great. Because yeah. I do love my book, and I do love, you know, especially the poems that include my children. Let me go ahead and read. Wait, no. Da-da-da-da. Let me read one in honor of my son. And this is on page 73. It's called Lunar Navigator. My child, my son, his body embraces his age awkwardly. 13, he's memorized maps of the moon. From the light of the northwestern limb to the shadows of the crater Grimaldi, and he dreams of a reality without gravity. Feathers and stones, stones and feathers. He knows how to calculate his weight on Mars. He can tell you how many light years to the spiral galaxy. He can explain why a rock and a penny drop to the Earth with the same velocity. But he cannot find his face because he can't find a hand to push the hair from his own forehead, look the girl he likes in the eye and smile. That's my band.
Read a new one.
Okay, this is the wad of paper. This is how I work. It's sad to say, but it's true. What I'm doing right now is I'm doing a series of ekphrastic poems, and ekphrastic poems are poems that are written in response to different artwork. And my idea was to start at the beginning of time. Because to me, what makes us human, what connects us one to another, in a big way, it is art. Art is humanity. It's not just this thing on the side. It doesn't just reflect humanity. It is, in a very literal way, humanity. And so with that in mind, I wrote some pieces following down the hand, or falling down like the timeline from the beginning. And I'll go ahead and since I said that, I'm kind of forced to start here, so I'm at the beginning. And this is the cave paintings in France, I don't know if I can pronounce this.
Lascaux.
It's Rosedor cave paintings. I took German, not French. Rosedor cave paintings. Rosedour. Okay, well, that was the earliest ones I could find, the most ancient. Prehistory. Oh, let me show the picture. It's pretty, isn't it? So we began in darkness. It has been decided. When we speak of the charcoal handprints, we should not say he. Rather, consider the traveler who sought umber and burnt bone. There are no absolutes, you tell me. Every mother, soon after giving birth, will unfold the fingers of her child's hand, kiss the red ochre center of his palm. Let's leave carbon dating out of this. The delight in tracing this pattern will continue until that day the pencil is held in his own hand and the first word he wants to write, two mountains with the sun in between.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My husband complains that I write really sad poems all the time, but... So I had a really bad week. I really use words as flotation devices. So let me...
Burn out, they said.
I can see. So pardon me for being messy and stuff, but I'm just going to throw... This one I kind of like. This isn't... Let's not talk about my bad week yet. Let's... All right, this is a picture from 1st century BC Roman, and it's a cameo fragment with Jupiter astride an eagle. And the name of these poems are, they're the same as the artwork. So it's a beardy, fuzzy guy riding an eagle. Oh, well, there goes God again. Or what I mean to say is, iconography, let me stick my tongue in your ear. Or what I mean to say is I want a God like this one, one I can wear, one whose nose I can rub my thumb down. That's a lie. The heart is a traveler. You already know this. How it desires most fiercely what the hands can't hold, apotheosis, the journey home, but not the familiar skin of earthly landscapes, not the mountain, but the wanting of such heights. So when I say feather, you may consider the flight of the eagle, but I want it to mean the white owl is at rest. The common dove's coo is enough to awaken the world. That's actually a happier poem. How many Rachels does it take to screw in the lights?
It's not good.
Yeah.
That might be
uh-huh.
The
oh. And let there be light.
The answer is none.
Just one foot in the light.
There we go.
Yeah. I guess I can pick this one. It's fun. We'll need it. Let somebody change the mold out.
Dang it, I don't have my favorite one. Maybe I do.
Are you working on another book?
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've got like 30 poems, so I guess we could call it working on another book. I call it living from day to day and finding ways to keep saying.
Flotation device.
Flotation devices.
I like that. That's a good one.
That's
it is.
It is. That's a good one.
That's what it is.
That goes in next week's newsletter. As the
so.
Quote.
Yes.
The quote in the newsletter next week.
Words are my flotation device.
Words are my flotation device.
Yeah.
Words are my what?
Sorry?
Because what you said, words are
flotation device.
My flotation device.
It's like a life jacket.
Cheating.
Oh, you have it on your computer.
I do. In the meantime, while I'm waiting for that to load, let me read this one. Okay, this made me think of Hollins. The Garden of False Learning. I love my alma mater. 1550 AD, basically. And it's French. It's wool and silk on canvas. When I started this, I thought, I'm just going to look at all these wonderful paintings. But I found that I was really attracted to sculptures and fabrics.
Mm.
And that's what I responded to. So that's what I wrote to. And this came... Yeah, basically it is about Hollins, I won't lie. But it's a tapestry,
mm-hmm.
And it's hard to see, I know, but there's, in the picture, there's people playing flutes, and there's a lot of women, and there's a gate. So, the Garden of False Learning. Of course, there's music and blue mountains. But I don't see a row of corn or green pepper anywhere, so the problem is not vegetable. People take the place of trees, that's an issue. When did the garden become such an aesthetic? Just grab your crown of happiness and run. Men are bigger than houses here, it makes no sense. One man holds the earth in his hands and there is a gate. There is always a gate and an entryway. Someone on the outside, while inside there is the happy gathering of skirts that can't be ignored. But this is only the second leg of the journey. You know the wayfarer? Before he was born, he learned all he needed to know and forgot it as soon as he began. Yeah, I'm all philosophical. So as I'm doing this, if you have any questions or anything, feel free. This, I'm very casual.
Do you have any particular influences or who do you consider poets who influenced you?
Yeah. Which poet did you admire the most?
Put me on the spot. Who do I love? I love so many.
Promiscuous.
I am a poet whore. I do. I have so many I love, both men and women. I am very fond of Eliot's quatrains. Gertrude Stein, just because she was like the first, although she annoys me. Oh, let me think. Mary Oliver. Mm. I would have to say Mary Oliver, Adrian Rich, Lala Deed. She's an ancient poet. I don't know how many people know about her. Jane Hirschfeld, most definitely. Lake and Maple is probably one of my favorite poems of hers and has stuck with me. Wow. Who am I reading now? There's like modern poets right now that I really am finding amazing, that people don't know about, and they're not really well read, but I'm really inspired by my contemporaries, and they feed me, you know, both mentally, intellectually, and spiritually. So Lois Bogan, she's an Australian. There's really so many. I mean, I think every poem I've ever read, every poet I've ever studied, it's back there in your brain. You cannot help but carry them with you in some way, even if you're not consciously trying to be influenced by them. How can you not be, to some degree, part of the history of what makes poetry today? So, I don't know if that answered the question either.
I think it's always hard to pin down. You know, sometimes there are just specific poems by certain people that speak to you more than other poems by other people. I mean, it's not necessarily an author's whole work.
Right. Usually it's singular poems and even singular lines that stick in your brain. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot that sticks in my brain because being a mom. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
It was good to see you.
Sorry.
You're fired.
Thanks for coming. It's that
family thing.
Family. But yeah, and I think for me, my favorite poet is always the poet I'm reading today.
Right.
So,
when did you start writing?
When I was little. The first poem I wrote was in response to what's the name of the poet? The Selfish Giant. It was a book based on a poem, and it's gone now. But it's one of the romantic poets that wrote the poem. But the first poem I ever wrote was like in second grade in response to the Selfish Giant. And the giant wouldn't let the children play in his garden. And I thought that was horrible. So I wrote a poem to the giant and just admonished him that he should allow the children to play in the garden. Didn't he know that he was wrong? But yeah, I remember that. And so in that way, it's always been like there in the comfort and a way for me to understand what's going on around me. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it helps me to know and to realize and understand difficult things that happen, and then sometimes it just helps me get through it. It doesn't help me understand. It just helps me deal.
Do you feel like you're still influenced by any of your teachers from home?
I have tried really hard not to be.
it's always an interesting thing to
while I was there, they would ask me to do something one way, and intentionally I would do it the opposite way just because they would ask me to do it that way. Because I was that kind of person. I don't know if that was good or bad, but... yeah, their fingers are still there. I can feel them. They're still there to some degree. With that collection, I definitely... Because a lot of those poems were written in their classes. Mm-hmm. So they were workshopped in their classes. So their fingers are in there. Mm-hmm. With this one, no. They're not there. This one, I feel like, even more than that, this one is definitely more my voice... me coming from from cutting away from influence of academia or whatever. But
I remember many years ago I took a course in poetry writing, and it was at Piedmont, and anybody who had a pulse could enter, you know. Everybody submitted something, and it was really kind of amazing because everybody would critique it, and the quality of the poems, I say, went from minus zero to, you know, quite high. And you have poems like, "Oh, I'm so sad since you left me. I cannot go to sleep, blah, blah." You know, and the people would say, "Oh, well, that was very sweet." You know, so there was, you know.
That still happens today.
Yeah. So, anyway, you have these declarations of, you know, I got out of bed the wrong side, or something like that. Totally trivial. People would always be very complimentary, regardless of the things that was written. And I guess that's kind of sweet, but
not very helpful. Well, Holland's wasn't like that. No, people were not sweet there, and which was I like that. I'd rather have someone say this really sucks and tell me how to do it better than to be like, oh, yay, this is awesome. But depends on your workshop. Depends on your teacher.
I used to hear stories about an instructor who, this was in an MFA program, when they finished going over critiquing one person's poem, and each time this would happen, like, he would just wad the poem up like a ball and throw it back to the person.
You should have done that with mine the other day, Rose. First one.
No, I don't do that. But
I don't know.
Wanted to know if your kids have been influenced, and are they writing at all? Any of your kids interested?
My kids are so unimpressed. but yes, my oldest child writes, and then my 12-year-old, she writes and illustrates her own books. So, but for the most part, you know, they're like, are they? I feel completely horrible and guilty because we were driving down the road the other day, and I said, okay, trivia time. Can you tell me who wrote this? And I said, two roads diverge from a yellow wood. And sorry was I that I could not travel both. Who wrote that? Nobody could tell me. I was like, I have failed. Nobody knows this. It's so easy. Come on. But, I have recently told my children that we are having a poetry day because you are going to, before you leave this house, know something about poetry.
Are you homeschooling?
I'm not homeschooling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm just enforcing this out of sure meanness.
Oh, no. Good. Well, that's good.
But, yeah, are they influenced? They ask me when I do readings, they always ask me, can you read the poem about me? So,
yeah.
I guess they're happy that there are poems about them, but sure. Influenced, it's a mom thing, therefore not cool, therefore who cares? You know, maybe someday they'll be more influenced by it. But right now,
undoubtedly.
Yeah, right now they're baseball, they're softball, they're... Oh, yeah. Life and yeah, mom's got a poetry book. Woo! Big deal.
One thing that I find in many, mostly male writers, is that they are so individual. I mean, they talk about events or things that happen to them. You know, like for instance, as I was sitting on the cafe, so and so, I met the John, whatever, and. We had a specific event, and it has no resonance, I think, because you don't know the fair, you don't know the guy, you don't know anything, and so it is very, very private and very specific and special. And I wonder why bother put it in a poem, because if you write about your child. Presumably, other people have children, and they have the similar experiences. And so that is the name of the game, that you can extrapolate from what you read to the way you feel yourself about your situation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you are given just no help in that, in it being so arcane or so left field, why bother? Why bother reading? That's why I think women... Poets are more in touch with the emotions and what matters in life, in my opinion.
Well, some of my favorite poems and poets are men.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm thinking of modern males.
Modern. Richard Seekins. Silken has written a book called Crush, and he has a certain poem called Lines, a litany in which certain lines are crossed out. And also there's, let me think. Why is this book? There's... The approach to poetry, is kind of, it can be gender specific, but I think it's also, we use words to connect to each other. We use words to affirm our humanity. And I see that there are similarities in the way women and men do it, and there are differences. And I think Billy Collins, I don't know if you've read him.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read him? He's one that's very accessible, mm-hmm. and he's funny. And I think, you know, you're saying, like, what's the point of reading a poem if you don't connect to it or relate to it? He writes about subject matter that's humorous and mm-hmm. that you can connect to.
I'm thinking of specifically at the UVA-based poem called Charles Wright.
Charles Wright, Black Zodiac. Read the entire book.
I just read a few that I didn't connect with, and so I said, well,
he's very metaphysical.
Yeah.
And cosmic.
I'm not, I guess. So that's.
If you like physics and you like that kind of thing, and I kind of do. Mm-hmm. I liked his Black Zodiac. I related to some of it. The way the palm, there's a universe in your palm, and body parts as they relate to the cosmos. I could dig it.
I'm thinking we should break so sure. that people can have their books signed if they want the book.
That's probably a good idea. I have no idea what the time is.
It is
20 after I... Oh, sorry, yes. You had one that you're going to load up.
Oh,
a closing poem.
Okay. Do you want...
The one that was your favorite?
My favorite's always like the last poem I've written.
Good.
Read us that one.
And since we're kind of talking about women, no disparity to your men folk.
I can leave the room.
No. No.
May I ask how old this poem is?
This poem is a month. A month. Yes. Yeah. And I don't have a picture to show you, really. It's Charity, mid-16th century, Franco-Flemish, yeah, that word, alabaster. What they don't tell you about Charity is that they flattened her back, and after washing the garments of all the children in all the world, the river ran dry, the washboard broke, and she seriously contemplated suicide. They don't mention how much she travels alone or how her feet have taken to falling off every 1,000 miles or so, and nothing is ever said about the gnawed look of her flesh in the light, and at night she doesn't sleep. She looks and looks for her sisters in the sky, and for years and years now she's been lost. Though some say they have seen her lying silent and prone atop the mounds of the slaughtered, but I only know her amid the wildflowers in a meadow. Her eyes, empty bowls, and her mouth wide open to catch the falling stars. I can see her counting until she gets to the crown, and here, whenever she sees Cassiopeia hanging upside down, she begins again. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for coming.